Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the United Nations Secretary General has called Syria hell on earth. How did it get this bad? What are the geopolitics? What about the rest of the Middle East? We'll spend the hour answering these questions. Laurie Brand joins us. She is a professor of international relations and Middle East studies at the University of Southern California and a past president of the Middle East Studies Association of North America. She's the author of Palestinians in the Arab World, Institution Building and the Search for State, Jordan's Inter-Arab Relations, The Political Economy of Alliance Making, Women, the State and Political Liberalization, and Official Stories, Politics and National Narratives in Egypt and Algeria. Fred Lawson is also with us. He is a professor of government at Mills College and a visiting professor, National Security Affairs, at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. His publications include Bahrain, The Modernization of Autocracy, Constructing the International Relations in the Arab World, Why Syria Goes to War, 30 Years of Confrontation, and Global Security Watch, Syria. Hamoud Salhi also joins us. He's a professor of political science and the Middle East. He's also the associate dean of the College of Social and Natural Sciences at California State University, Dominguez Hills. William Harris is with us. He's a professor of politics at Otago University and an award-winning author. His books include Lebanon, A History, The Levant, A Fractured Mosaic, and his latest, Quicksilver War, Syria, Iraq, and the Spiral of Conflict. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you here with us to talk about the crises going on in the Middle East. The notes that I saw were that there have been some 250,000 people killed just in Syria alone, and 5 million have fled it. It seems like we have multiple humanitarian crises throughout the Middle East. Laurie Brand, would you say it's a fair assessment to say it's the worst condition we've seen in the Middle East?
I think certainly in terms of numbers of people displaced and people who look to be displaced for sort of the medium, perhaps to the long term. I mean, if you think back to the the Palestine War in 1947-48, you had somewhere in the neighborhood of 600,000-700,000. Maybe as some estimates go as high as 900,000 Palestinians who were displaced. And so given the relative population size at the time, perhaps that, that should also go up, be considered among some of the periods of worse population displacement. But I mean, in terms of the number of different places where this is going on, I think it certainly is unparalleled in the time that I've been studying the region.
Fred Lawson.
And I think too that the level of lethality of the weapons too is just so much greater than it was 20 years ago. The kinds of explosives, the kinds of extent that some of these bombs and missiles can have, rips through buildings, rips through infrastructure, and so the destructiveness and the harm to human life is just so great at the moment.
That was Fred Lawson. Bill Harris, what would you add?
I would certainly agree with both previous contributions. The numbers thing is something that we only have a very rough handle on, of course. I mean, you referred to 250,000 in Syria. There seems to be some general acceptance of something like 350,000. Other people go higher than that still. It's very hard to get a solid grip on the actual numbers that we're dealing with here, except they are of that sort of magnitude.
And that is just Syria alone. Of course, we've got all of the neighboring states dealing with something to some effect, Palestine, Yemen. Does anybody have a sense of what's happening in Yemen?
Well, I mean, this combined, primarily Saudi, but Saudi UAE, backed by the United States and Britain, assault on, I mean, justified in terms of fighting the Houthis, who are, purported to be the main entree for the Iranians into that part of the peninsula. I mean, this assault has just been devastating. The Saudis have been charged with war crimes for targeting hospitals and schools. And of course, they claim that it's not intentional. But I mean, there's no reason to suspect that that they're telling the truth in that regard. And the problem, of course, with Yemen was that the extent of state development anyway was rather limited. And so while while the numbers of people who are actually displaced may be smaller than we see in some other areas, the degree of state healthcare infrastructure was extremely limited. And so we have this cholera epidemic in Yemen, which is unprecedented in the region, I believe, at least since the Second World War. This is dreadful. And, you know, the Saudis, after destroying all of this, now they're and closing ports, so basically making it impossible to bring in humanitarian aid to try and alleviate some of the suffering, including hunger, right? They're going to give $1 billion in aid. It's really pornographic. I mean, it's truly unconscionable. And, you know, the United States, which talks about, the problems with the Saudi effort or what the Saudis are doing, has completely downplayed the kind of role that we are engaged in supporting what's been going on there. And it gets much less attention than Syria, but I think the human suffering and the devastation and therefore the possibilities for any kind of recovery, I mean, we can't even talk about recovery because we've got sort of multiple battles that are going on as well over what's happening in the north, and now there's apparently a new threat of some sort of secessionist movement in the south, and so it's truly a humanitarian disaster of the first order.
I see Hamoud Salhi just joined us. Welcome, Hamoud Salhi. It's great to have you with us here as well. Can you hear me okay? No, Hamoud can't hear me. Okay. Well, we'll just go on into the next section then. I'm thinking that...
It's William here. Can I just make a quick point? I think
yes,
Laurie
please.
Brought up something very important, which is the targeting of particular infrastructure like hospitals. And we're seeing that in Syria as well, where it's quite plainly deliberate.
If you were going to describe the Syrian situation in terms of the hospitals and the civilians that are getting targeted, Bill Harris, how would you describe it? I know you've been there.
Well, not in Syria during this war. I've been in northern Iraq, but therefore can only go on indirect indicators as to what we see. From a distance, but that certainly tells us that it's really bad, that it's and it's been going on for such a long time, and it involves so many parties.
Can we talk about how we got to this point? Like, how did it get this bad? Bill Harris, you talked a bit about this in your new book. Do you want to start that?
If we're talking simply about the conglomerate of problems we've had in Syria and Iraq since 2011, I'm pretty much of the view, and I know people will disagree with this, that this is a matter, if we consider things in a structure agency way, this is very much a matter in terms of Syria of the personal agency of the ruler. And I know that's a controversial statement, but that's something.
Can you explain what you mean by that for people in the audience who don't really?
I'm talking about Bashar al-Assad.
Yeah.
How he performed as president and ruler of Syria from his advent in 2000 through that decade, and then the decisions he plainly made in conjunction with his surrounding clique. In 2011, as we moved from the protests to the descent into warfare, and then the very heavy engagement of heavy weaponry from the Syrian armed forces into 2012 and into the middle of 2012, and then it just spread all over the place from that point onwards in terms of the numbers of parties involved and the offenses against human rights from various directions. But I very much see a strong role for the personal agency of the ruler in this matter. And I don't really connect the American entry into Iraq and all the things that happened there, which are really bad and so forth. But to connect that with what then happened in Syria, which I've heard from some quarters, that one somehow can be conflated and leads into the other, I think you have to have very direct evidence of that. And the Syrian affair was very, to me, a very much a domestic evolution. But I think it's probably best if I leave it at that point.
Well, let's bring Fred Lawson in. Would you agree with that assessment, Fred?
One thing we see in Syria is that the war polarized communities along religious lines, and various religious groups started to resort to terrorism and extreme forms of violence to get their, to establish control over territory and to exert their will over other populations. And as the violence kept escalating, the level of punishments, the level of retaliation that takes place across Syria really does bring a different dimension of warfare, makes the level of harm, the level of physical damage against humans so much greater in the Syrian civil war than it might be in other kinds of civil wars. And even after those groups get pushed out, the memory of that violence and the legacy of that violence goes on. And we see, for instance, the Kurdish communities up in northern Syria retaliating against groups that might have cooperated with Islamic State, and some of the Kurdish groups even extending the violence into other communities in a kind of preventive way to establish unitary control, homogeneous control over the north part of the country. So the dynamics of violence and of religion and of terrorism have come to a zenith in this conflict, the one in Syria.
And in memory, it's like what you're saying is it's once you've started the violence and once people equate groups and violence, it just can spin out of control is what it sounds like you're saying. What about the geopolitics, Fred Lawson? It sounds like Bill Harris was saying it mostly rests with Assad and not with geopolitics.
Oh, I didn't exactly say that. I'm Sir William here. I'm just making a punt for the quite heavy role of Bashar al-Assad in the triggering and initial evolution of this thing. I think one thing that's interesting from what both perhaps what Fred has said as well is that you can integrate what I've said with what he said quite easily, and then adding extra layers and dimensions to it. And this just illustrates what a multifaceted affair we're dealing with here. And of course, you're absolutely right. We have to bring in at this point the heavy involvement of several regional powers, and two great powers. I mean, obviously Russia and the United States, and then we have Turkey, which we haven't mentioned up to this point, and obviously also Israel and Iran. And plainly, we've seen a major incident in that regard just in the last week or so.
Well, would you like to, Bill Harris, kind of break down how you see the geopolitics and what it is that they want? I mean, what's the point of completely destroying a place? What are they getting out of this?
Well, Syria has a critical geopolitical location. I mean, the regional powers we're talking about surround it. And given the wider circumstances of conflict in the region, and we could bring in Saudi Arabia and Iran here as well. None of them want to see the others steal a strong move on them. Iran obviously has quite strong ambitions in terms of reaching across to the Mediterranean for whatever reasons. The Israelis want to counter that. The Turks regard themselves as having existential interests in what happens in northern Syria, and we're seeing that work itself out in Afrin at the moment. And then there is the Russian interest in projecting itself as a great power, and Russia's involvement here relates to things that have nothing to do with Syria in the Middle East, such as how Russia feels it's been treated, or how this regime in Russia feels Russia has been treated since the Cold War and so forth, and wants to reposition itself and be respected as a major power, and the whole Syrian affair becomes part of that. So we can just go on in that regard.
You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the geopolitics of the Middle East. Laurie Brand, what would you say to the regional geopolitics?
Well, I guess one of the things that I wanted to highlight, because I think it gets lost in all of this, and yet when we're talking about humanitarian suffer. I mean, we're talking about suffering and potential humanitarian disasters. What's happening in the Gaza Strip is, Palestine in general has been to a large extent sidelined by the understanding focus of people on what's been happening in Iraq and Syria, and now focusing more heavily just on Syria, and then on this sort of these shifting alliances among the various powers that are at work in the sort of the Syria-Iraq complex, but also the increasing competition that's going on between Gulf states, the siege of Qatar, and so on. So there's so much that's happening now in the region that it's very easy to forget about what's happening in Palestine. And the continuing suffering of the people of Gaza, the tremendous level of unemployment, of poverty, inadequate access to adequate water, the failure to rebuild largely from the last war with Israel. I mean, these are ongoing serious human and political dramas that get lost. We had the U.S. administration basically declaring that it's going to move its embassy to Jerusalem, the Palestinians saying that they're no longer going to talk to the United States. Now, apparently today, Nikki Haley at the U.N. said, we're willing to talk to the Palestinians again. Like, that's some, grandiose gesture. But the failure to solve this problem and the absence of legitimacy of the current recognized Palestinian leadership, the sort of lack of a strategy going forward, and the continuing encroachment of Israel on territory in the West Bank, and the sort of the combined strangulation of Gaza by Israel, Egypt, the United States and others is a dreadful saga as well, that while it may not, in terms of comparison with Syria, it may not match the level of human suffering, but this is also, a drama that's been going on for decades. And so I just wanted to try and put that also back into the mix, because we really should not lose sight of this. And unfortunately, I think the current administration looks to be preparing some sort of a quote unquote peace, this great deal that they're talking about, given the tremendous weakness of the Palestinians at this point, they may find a way just to impose on them. So I think that we really need to keep this in view as well.
Hamoud Salhi, welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm glad you finally got the technology working. Thank you for being with us. We've been talking about the whole region. We talked quite a bit about Syria. I know you couldn't hear us while we were doing that. We talked about Yemen a bit, now Palestine, and we're talking about geopolitics and the humanitarian disasters that are ongoing in that region. What would you say to these issues?
Well, there are several issues. One of them is the whole makeup of the Middle East, the formation of the state. It seems that how the states have formed in the Middle East are one of the root causes of what's happening today. The issue of representation, the issue of social equality, even the right of the state, what's the state supposed to do, has never been addressed. And then we seem to be flirting with the idea of, having this notion that the Arab regimes are untouchable, and they have survived all the challenges, the latest of which is, a good example, Egypt. We went from major revolution, hope, to a major disaster by some accounts. So we have that issue, that the issue of governance, the issue of representation is very serious. The second thing is also, and connected to that, is the fact that you have the civil society has been so much divided. And it seems that those who spoke well for this civil society to be of a brand, a religious brand, that is somehow tweaked in different ways, either using terrorism as a form of expression or violence, or moderate, or in between the state who also claims to this right of Islamization. So the idea of ideology, of belief, or the whole superstructure the Marxist talks about is yet also discussed seriously. So there are a lot of variables. But the other thing that we've seen in the recent years is that there has been sort of, at one point or another, certain kind of nationalism in the Arab world. We've seen it in the 60s where you have the Nasser, you know, the nationalist military who took to power, who were really anxious about serving the Arab world cause, only to prove that they are also having their own issues. Typical example against Egypt, you could take Algeria from that perspective. But we have leaders who were very instrumental in having certain kind of impact in the Middle East. What's happening recently, particularly in the recent decades or so, is that you really have an absence of leadership, particularly in the case of the current crisis in the Gulf region, in Syria. What you've seen is that you've seen these new leaders, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates. Of all places, United Arab Emirates has sort of had tendencies with Sheikh Zayed as one of the pro-supporters of Arab nationalism of Palestine. Well, the United Arab Emirates is now has no problem with dealing with the Israelis. So it's this new leadership that has been sort of, that is formed in the West, close to the United States, and more than one really doesn't understand the very nature or what's happening in the Middle East. They seem to be living out of touch with the realities. So you have decisions made. You have a Saudi Arabia, which now has an open foreign policy. We've never seen that. The United Arab Emirates, which used to be very, very careful in its dealing even with the Iranians, now is in Yemen and fighting to some account for whatever reason it's doing it. So there are multiple reasons, causes for this. And it's sadly enough, in the absence of all of this, I mean, you find that, I don't know who wrote this recently, where they said, you know, in all this crisis, I mean, we talk about Israel, we talk about Iran, we talk about United States, Russia, absence in this formula is the Arab themselves. Where is the Arab leaders in all this equation? They are not there. And that's really the main thing. It's a new day. It's a new situation. And it's sadly, when you have a crisis like this, it's difficult to predict. And I think the recent meeting, the European meeting, the Security Council, which predicted or talked about a world war in the Middle East, is a clear warning that we need to think seriously about what's happening.
Fred Lawson.
We usually think of civil wars as being domestic affairs and being driven by internal dynamics. But as Laurie reminded us, a lot of the fighting that's going on now is taking place close to the borders of these various countries. The fighting in Gaza is clearly connected to the insurgency going on in Sinai. The fighting down in the south part of Syria is clearly connected to Hezbollah intervention and to a flashpoint along the Golan Heights. The fighting up in northern Syria is clearly spilling across the border into Turkey and so on. And so what we have along all of these borders is partly efforts by states worried about surveillance on the border, worried about territorial conflicts of one kind or another. And also, I think, as we just heard, there's a concern about nationalism. There's a concern about different kinds of cultural markers along the northern Syrian border, along the border between Gaza and Egypt. And Laurie has written cogently about the way nationalism fits into international relations in this part of the world. And if we look at, say, this northern Kurdish entity in the north part of Syria, a crucial question is to what extent some kind of autonomous nationalism might take shape up there along the border. It seems to me that's what Turkey is most worried about. Turkey is most worried about some autonomous entity that looks out only for Kurdish interests all along Turkey's southern border.
Bill Harris, would you agree?
Yes, I would. And I just wanted to add something. There's something that we haven't seen before here in terms of the involvement of the non-Arab states, the central involvement of non-Arab regional powers, all of them simultaneously, Israel, Turkey, and Iran, in the depth of the Arab world. And I think that comes back to something we've just been hearing about, the state of crisis and decomposition in a large part of the Arab world, especially since 2011, although it obviously links to background things long before then. But the opening now and to the non-Arab regional powers to take a very direct hand at depth in the affairs of the Arab world is quite notable, I think, at this point.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. And we're talking about the geopolitics of the Middle East. You know, it made me wonder a little bit about the Arab revolutions that I think so many people felt hopeful about, like what might happen resulting from them. And it seems today that they have been mass failures. Would you agree with that? Or do you think there was something good that came of them? Laurie Brand, what would you say? Arab revolutions?
Well, you know, I think there's a presumption that a revolution would it basically means to turn over, right? It doesn't mean by definition that what comes after it or is going to be better. We tend to think that something better would come of it, but that's not necessarily the case. So that's one thing I would make. And I think that's been borne out in the number of these countries. I mean, the one place that still appears to hold out promise is Tunisia, although there's been some serious, I think, authoritarian backsliding there as well. So it's not clear how much longer we're going to be able to point to Tunisia. I mean, I hope we will be able to still another few years as continuing to hold out hope and to trying to forge a different way forward following its revolution. Another case is what we've seen have been, I mean, people wrote about it at the time, we call counter-revolutions, and that is Arab states or various regimes that as they saw these various popular uprisings unfolding in the different ways that they did across the region, that saw their own interests significantly threatened. And so then you get this backlash in a variety of ways. The most, perhaps the ugliest of ways, as we saw in Bahrain, where the Saudis basically just, you know, rolled in and literally crushed the incipient revolt. Then what's happened in Syria, of course, ends up being in part proxy war, and then it's gone through various stages where you have this proliferation of different actors, and then the involvement of all sorts of external actors, which Bill and Fred have both spoken about. So the monarchies, the Saudis and the Emiratis, in particular, had a strong interest in trying to make sure that what came out of these various uprisings was not going to be something that was going to be threatening to them. And so hence the kind of support that they gave for different groups in various parts of the region, including, in the case of Egypt, where we know now that the Emiratis appeared to have had a strong hand in this supporting this Tamarrud movement, which was what ended up calling for Morsi's ouster, and which has then set Egypt on what's been a dreadful path. I mean, we were talking about this, Fred was talking about the terrible violence that's been unleashed. I mean, the kind of violence that we saw in Egypt in the quote-unquote dispersal of the demonstrations in Rabaa Square, for example, in Cairo is just unprecedented in modern Egyptian history. And this kind of virulent, continuing pursual of anybody and anything that they can tag a Muslim Brotherhood moniker on is also quite frightening, I think. So even in a place like Egypt, where feels like you can set the Sinai aside, and perhaps we shouldn't say that, where Sisi is attempting to continue to rule with this bloody iron fist.
Fred Lawson.
Well, I agree with Laurie. It is a different kind of authoritarianism. It's a kind of authoritarianism that is not so old-fashioned, not so simplistic in the way that it works. I mean, the new authoritarianism in Egypt has a kind of subtlety to it, a kind of velvet glove around the fist. And I think we see that even in Saudi Arabia today as well. Saudi Arabia had a popular uprising out in Eastern Province and in some of the poorer parts of the central part of the country as well. And those uprisings were crushed, but they were crushed with concessions related to them, with promises of reform in the future. And so the new authoritarianisms across the region may be a lot harder to combat than the old obvious authoritarianisms were.
And I think Syria is a very specific example of an uprising, an attempted revolution going probably as bad as it could possibly go. Would you say that's right?
Well, the Syrian uprising certainly does go off the rails. Now that the militant Islamists have been crushed, now that some of the popular militias have been run out of the country or are sent packing into the hills, one thing we might want to look at is whether or not some of the civil rights activists who stayed in Damascus and who formed sort of the internal opposition or internal critics of the regime get any chance at all to institute any reforms. I mean, will the current Ba'athi government in Syria open the door at all to any kind of popular expression or any kind of civic organizations, having crushed the militant Islamists?
Bill Harris?
I'm pretty skeptical about that, and I'm sure Fred is himself as well. I mean, their backers are not their Russian and Iranian backers are not much minded towards anything like that, except perhaps the Russians to a degree, because the Russians have this view. Laurie or Fred just saying about the situation in Egypt, the velvet glove, etc. The Russians are a little bit attuned to dealing with things in that way. But I would be pretty skeptical that those people can have any weight in anything like the near future. And then something we haven't really gone into at all is because of the character of this Trump administration, the absence of the United States from this arena, the fact that we just in northern Syria, for example, we quite plainly simply have a tactical holding operation with no strategic direction, no serious strategic direction, no idea from the administration in Washington as to what sort of future they would envisage for Syria. We just have no idea. There seems to be no strategic direction at all here.
I do think the U.S. has said that it will be in Syria indefinitely. The question is to what degree and how.
Well, that's definitely as a holding operation.
Also, Washington finally did make a strategic choice in Syria, and it made a strategic choice to line up with the democratic forces of Syria up in the north, the forces that are clustered around the local Kurdish militia. And that choice not only alienated the Turks, but that choice also makes it really difficult for the United States to have broad leverage or broad presence in other parts of the opposition. Some parts of the Syrian opposition don't even consider the Kurdish movement in the north as being part of the opposition. They think that it's just a client of the regime in Damascus. And so because the United States made that particular choice, the United States really is stuck between a couple of very powerful forces in the Syrian case. It's stuck between the Turks on one side and the Russians, Syrians, and Iranians on the other side.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the humanitarian crises in Syria and its surrounding nations. So if we had a different administration in the United States, how would you see this developing? Hamoud?
I mean, if you take the message, the narrative, the tone, I would not expect any difference. A reason for it, when you examine and look at the nature of American foreign policy throughout history, you see really continue. Leaders build on precedent policies. A clear example, we talked about, you know, preemptive strategy that George W. Bush used to invade Iraq. The idea of preemptive strategy was under Clinton administration, and Clinton came with it when, on a daily basis, at a time when Iraq had no weapons as per the United Nations, where daily sorties by airplane bombarded what considered to be potential threats to American national interests, and potential threat meant also bombing economic facilities. facilities, pharmaceutical areas, and that strategy, that preemptive strategy, was used by George W. Bush. The opening to Iran began in 2006 under Condoleezza Rice with George W. Bush, and we've seen what Barack Obama did. So there is this continuum, and I'm not a believer in the fact that Obama was indecisive, disengaged. The American troops were there. The difference today is that the Americans, President Trump, for his own personal agenda, or perhaps other agendas, are being more vocal, are involved using military attacks against Syrian targets, increase the number of observers. But that's consistent. If we were in this position at this time under Obama administration, I could see this happen again. So from that perspective, I don't see any change. A different administration would not make a change. The difference is the narrative, the tone that is used. People during the Middle East under Obama administration longed for the area of George W. Bush, not because George W. Bush was a nice guy, was a decent guy, from their perspective. No, because he was frank with them. He invaded Iraq and he said he did this. Obama didn't do that. He had two faces as the Middle East perceived them. So to a large degree today, Trump is but a representation of, it is another representation of American foreign policy, and I don't see it different. But there is a very serious issue that we have to consider in this discussion, is the fact that this chaos, the civil wars are occurring in places that have a big impact in the geopolitics of the Arab world. It's no wonder that, you know, Egypt is going through a crisis, Yemen, the cradle of civilization, as some would call it, Iraq, all of these places in the Arab world. Iraq was at one point a strong player against Israel. In all of this, there is this dimension of the external threat. Today in the Middle East, doesn't appear to be the Israelis, but it appears to be the Shia, the idea that there is a threat to this existential threat to the region, and it doesn't emanate from the Israelis, it emanates from other religious groups. And what's very interesting, I just come back from Algeria, and for the first time I heard groups and friends who actually use the same narrative that we need to sort of address this issue of Shiism. You never found this before, but the narrative has changed, and that is a big issue in the future, and it may dictate where the Middle East is going. The idea that, for example, today the Americans are no longer, or put it outside the discussion of Jerusalem, the discussion of the refugees are no longer part of the discussion. All of these issues are very serious to consider. Short term, they may be sort of you may achieve certain positive results, but in long term, they can be difficult, and that is really the challenge for us. Will the core issue, the Arab-Israeli conflict, particularly the Palestinian issue, resolved, surface again and change the dynamics of what we see today?
Laurie Brand.
I think that if one looks at it, was, well, we're trying to figure out if things would have looked different other than a Trump administration. I mean, I suppose it's possible that a next administration could have come in and shifted their stance on the agreement with Iran. But I think that would have been unlikely with Hillary Clinton, given that she was, you know, part of the Obama administration. So I do think the fact that the Trump threatens that, and that he's been sort of held back to date, I think doesn't necessarily augur that he won't try and upset that deal going forward. So I think there is that, which does mark this administration from other possible administrations that we might have had. The other thing I think is that, and again, this gets, I'm generally not a proponent of or a big fan of sort of the individual in politics, but I do think that the combination of this of Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia and this apparent friendship that he struck with Jared Kushner, the way that Trump's trip to the Gulf unfolded, which seems to have given the Saudis thought that they had, you know, so the green light to to threaten Qatar and impose a siege. I mean, I think I'm not sure we would have seen that in another administration, in a different administration, Hillary Clinton one or someone else's. And I do think that the short to medium term impact of that, of this increasing exacerbation of the of tensions between GCC members, which basically renders the GCC, I mean, even though it wasn't the most powerful or influential organization, nonetheless, I think significantly fractures it. I mean, I think that is an important development of the region. It's important in thinking about what happens in Yemen. It's important in thinking about what happens in, in Syria going forward. So I do think that those are at least two points that are significant and that might distinguish what we're seeing now from what we would have seen in a different administration.
I think on the issue of Iran, I am agree, but in general, and I do respect Laurie, thank you for hanging your input on this and being part of this program with you. There are patterns. For example, when you look at the discussion about lifting the sanction under Iraq, that Iraq was under during the Clinton administration, the word was against for lifting the sanction. Madeleine Albright led that effort to say no. So it's not a precedent for the United States executives, the Secretary of State, and the President to go against the norm. What others expected. The expectation today is that the Iranian deal is a done deal. It's good for the international community, and the United States should not be against it. But my point to that is that there are precedents where the United States acted against the will of the people. And the plan today in the United States perhaps, is very well related to what the old preemptive doctrine. Remember when the United States invaded Iraq, the Fuad Ajami wrote his famous article in Foreign Affairs where he told the readers, United States told George W. Bush specifically, go and invade the Arab world, invade Iraq, they will receive you for roses. Don't worry about the Arab street. They will demonstrate. They will hang you. They will all do that. But remember, the Arab street is like the iron. They get hot very, very fast and get cold very, very fast. The prediction of Fuad Ajami and others was, we invade Iraq, and then it's a matter of decision. Shall we go? Or a matter of convenience, shall we go to Syria or Iran? Well, Syria is destroyed. Now it's Iran. When we look at the plan, what the Congress is doing, the Free Iran Act, all the sanctions are well within what you've seen happening before the invasion of Iraq. So there is a pattern there. So I don't expect another administrator, Hillary Clinton or somebody else, to do things other than what we've seen from Trump. This is not to defend Trump, but to argue, and I agree, there are personalities, there are a lot of things that are in play, and in the Middle East particularly, politics matters very, very well. And so it's very significant, the relationship that exists between the Saudis and leaders and the Americans should be taken into account. But I think the tone, the style may be different, but the end result is to a large degree similar.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. So what I'd like to do is shift to a conversation about what is even possible in terms of resolving to any degree the humanitarian crises that are going on there. And if there's anything we can look to say that there's some possibility, because it doesn't really look like there is. Fred Lawson, what do you say?
Well, when we look at Syria right at the moment, what we see is that the Syrian government and the Russian Air Force have decided to just plain obliterate any remaining rebels, any remaining critics or opposition that are either down in the south around Damascus or that are up in the north around Idlib. And with that kind of decision, I mean, that kind of action and that kind of indiscriminate destruction and violence, it just seems to me there should be a way to ostracize that kind of action, to create some sort of international consensus that would make those two actors look so awful carrying out that kind of activity, that there could be some restraint and there could be some intervention by the International Red Cross or some other non-governmental organization to break these sieges. Now, as long as the United States is as blustery and as public in its diplomacy as it is, I don't have much hope that that kind of very subtle, very nuanced diplomacy could take place. But otherwise, the Syrian government and Russian Air Force will just keep blasting until every last one of the opposition militia fighters is killed.
Bill Harris.
I totally agree with Fred, but again, I have to, and I agree with him in being skeptical about there being any countermove vis-a-vis the combination of Bashar and Russia. I think, and another thing that does divert things a little bit, and maybe the Russians thought about this, is letting the Turks have their head in Afrin, because that distracts a bit from what's going on in Idlib and eastern Ghouta. So, yes, I basically agree with Fred on this, but I don't see any prospect of any improvement in this situation. I just see more deterioration.
Laurie Brandt?
I'm afraid I have to agree with both Bill and Fred. I mean, I just don't see, the will. I don't see the mechanisms for any sort of, aside from sort of an inexorable continuation and grinding on of the Syrian conflict anyway. And when it's kind of the same thing, I think, in terms of Yemen. And, you know, it's not, if we think just about the issue of refugees, the people who are displaced externally, you know, unfortunately, the region has a history of long-term refugee problems. This is the worst that we've ever seen, but it's extended displacement, with the responsibility ultimately for resettlement generally falling upon either the countries of the region, or, you know, the refugees themselves have to sort of figure it out. And that's why we continue to have refugees who are coming out of, you know, Afghanistan and other places trying to make their way to Europe. These problems, to which in this case, I think both Western countries, or for which both Western countries and various Middle Eastern actors bear primary responsibility, aren't going to take responsibility, I think, for settling any of this or resettling people. If anything, it seems to me what people seem already to be talking about, and I actually think this is going to be a very important topic going forward, is trying to, you know, outbid each other for reconstruction and their, you know, sort of purely profit motive in areas that appear to have finally been stabilized. So it's the sort of the rush for, you know, how can we rebuild in a way which is going to sort of pad our own budgets, our own wallets, rather than thinking about what happens in terms of the humanitarian situation. So I think things look dreadful for the near to midterm.
Bill, it's Bill here. Can I just put in a point here? I don't think this Russian regime thing is actually going to work. I don't think they have the weight to hold down Sunni Arab Syria like this into the long term. And this war is going to go through new phases. It may go into a crushed sort of insurgency phase, and then it will burst out again. And then, of course, there's another important factor here. Turkey is not just important with regard to the Kurdish situation. And this brings us back to the agency of the leader. Erdogan, I think, has a very distinctive momentum. And part of that momentum is his extreme hostility towards Bashar al-Assad, which bothers the Russians, and the Russians don't quite know how to handle that. And Turkey can make, once it's dealt with what it's dealing with at the moment, can make decisions with something like 3 to 4 million Syrians on its territory. There is a base for a cross-border insurgency into the long term. If Turkey turns out not to, or Erdogan turns out not to be too happy about his new Russian and Iranian friends as we go into one or two new phases. So I think we have to bear in mind that sort of thing. And in summary, for me, I just feel that the warfare in Syria is not going to end by under a rain of Russian bombs. It's going to go into new phases.
Hamoud Salhi?
A couple of things on the issue of refugees. The obvious example is that you have, since 1948, you have Palestinian refugees in areas we know very well, the refugee situation, despite what Israel, Israel has a role in that and the main culprit. But the Arab world get used to the idea of refugees. So that's the one issue. The second issue, there is also an attempt, I think, from the United States, to make this issue, the issue of refugees as a sort of a long, prolonged state of fact, it exists for a long time. The $1.27 billion aid that was given to, or that is going to be given to the Jordan for the next 5 years or 3 or 4 years, speaks to this issue that the aid that is coming to Jordan is perhaps intended to help find a solution to the refugees that are on its border. The Jordan have a large number of that. So there is an attempt. The third thing that comes with that is the effort of the international organizations, which has to this point been very encouraging, but limited to a large degree. The aid that is coming to this to the people are still to these people is very, very limited. So the problem will continue there, but it will continue to exist for a long time. And you know, the reason the issue of refugees became an issue in the Syrian refugees particularly is appealing to the image and showing up in the European countries and all of that. So the Western countries, the public relations, have yet to feel that this is an urgent problem, and until that problem is addressed, we continue to have that problem. And what damaging to this is that there are attempts by leaders some European leaders and this country's leaders to find linkages that these refugees are also terrorists, and as a result we should be having policies that restrict from helping them or finding a resolution to them. You could continue with the idea of promoting nationalism and so on and so forth. So it's a serious of problem. And until the United Nations, until the regional organization take it into account, I think we're going to have it. As for the Syrian conflict, I think what we've seen so far is that there are major players. The outside players, particularly the United States, the Turks, and particularly Russians, seems to be dictating what's happening on the ground. The discussion today is not whether Assad should go, but rather how to accommodate Assad. And more than anything else, we're looking now for strategic position, for geostrategic political assets. The United States is establishing itself with military bases. The Russians have done so for quite some time now, and the Turkish, as we know, they always negotiated their national interests to prevail over those of Syria. So those three countries, if they are able to reach a consensus that would benefit them, and I'm forgetting Iran, then Syria could be sort of reaching certain kind of order, not peace but order.
We've covered a lot of ground. I thank you all for your contribution to this conversation. I think it was really insightful for people, especially since a lot of the news has not been covering this in any kind of a depth. So people don't quite understand the degree to which these crises are occurring and why these things are occurring and what might be possible. So I thank you very much for your time. We've managed to go for an entire 55 minutes. Let's do a follow-up very soon.
Thanks, Marie. It's always nice to join you.
Lori Brand, a professor of international relations and Middle East studies at the University of Southern California and a past president of the Middle East Studies Association of North America. She's the author of Palestinians in the Arab World, Institution Building and the Search for State, Jordan's Inter-Arab Relations, The Political Economy of Alliance Making, Women, the State and Political Liberalization, and Official Stories, Politics and National Narratives in Egypt and Algeria. Fred Lawson is a professor of government at Mills College and a visiting professor, National Security Affairs, at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. His publications include Bahrain, The Modernization of Autocracy, Constructing the International Relations in the Arab World, Why Syria Goes to War, 30 Years of Confrontation, and Global Security Watch, Syria. Hamoud Salhi is a professor of political science and the Middle East. He is also the associate dean of the College of Social and Natural Sciences at California State University, Dominguez Hills. William Harris is a professor of politics at Otago University and an award-winning author. His books include Lebanon, A History, The Levant, A Fractured Mosaic, and his latest, Quicksilver War, Syria, Iraq, and the Spiral of Conflict. Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Armudian. See you next week.